just a ride. And we can change it anytime we want. It's only a choice. No effort, no work, no job, no savings of money. A choice right now between fear and love. The eyes of fear want you to put bigger locks on your door, buy guns, close yourself off. The eyes of love instead see all of us as one. Here's what we can do to change the world right now to a better ride. Take all that money we spend on weapons and defense each year and instead spend it feeding, clothing, and educating the poor of the world, which it would many times over, not one human being excluded, and we can explore space together, both inner and outer, forever in peace.
And now, coming to you live from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, in Duluth, Minnesota, Dreaming the New American Dream, with your hosts, Chuck Gregory and Mike Pelichek, brought to you by the Rock Creek Free Press.
It's been a wild week in this world. Japan has had one disaster after another. The first two were acts of God, the rest arguably self-inflicted. When you create technology that depends on the containment of vastly powerful fuel sources capable of exploding or poisoning you, it's not a stretch to say you're asking for trouble. There's a reason you don't see dirigibles floating around full of hydrogen. It was more dangerous than it was worth. Isn't that true of nuclear fission as well? Isn't it more dangerous than it's worth? Well, I'm just saying. A friend of mine says that development of technology is unstoppable. Disasters along the way are inevitable. He says that's how things happen, how we do things. We build something, try it out. Somewhere along the line, we discover we didn't do it right. Some people die. Then we try it a different way. Eventually, we learn to keep the deaths to an acceptable minimum. Well, whatever that is. Well, to me, the acceptable minimum death count is zero. Puts a bit of a crimp on the development of some things. And, well, I'm no Luddite. I do enjoy my technological toys. Without them, I wouldn't be talking to you now. But I think we need to be more certain of what we're doing. When we're wrong, we need to admit it. That's what I think. So Japan has shot themselves in the foot by using 55 reactors and having an earthquake followed by a tsunami. And they're in big, big trouble. A lot of debate over how much the trouble the rest of the world's in as a result of this mess. There may be a radioactive cloud sweeping across America right now. It's not likely that our government would tell us. It's not likely our government would allow us to get the information if there were any way they could stop it. Truth is a disappearing commodity. In any case, our hearts go out to the people of Japan, to all those facing sickness or death from nuclear fallout. I look forward to hearing more later in the show on this topic from Jack Cohen Joppa, our special guest tonight. He's been a nuclear resistor for a very long time. And now I'm going to turn the show over to my co-host, Mike Pelichek, an American writer.
Hey, Chuck, how you doing?
I'm good, Mike. I hope you're doing well.
Yeah, I'm doing fine. Reporting to you from the basement of our house tonight. I guess we're actually really an underground station now. We live in a duplex, and I'm trying to get away from the noise upstairs. If you hear a big pickup, just fire up a little bit later. Well, that's my neighbor going to work. He works overnight I think he's a game warden at the local reservation, I think is where he works. But tonight we have, along with Jack Cohen Joppa, we have Lee Herrick. She's in Minneapolis. Jack is in Tucson. And we're very excited to have him with us tonight. So, hello to everyone from Tucson and Minneapolis, Fort Lauderdale, Duluth. Happy St. Patrick's Day to everybody. My heritage is quarter Irish. Somebody came from County Cork in my family, but I didn't really hear too much more about that. And then there was somebody from Norway. And then my dad was full-blood Czech. So I guess I would be much, I've celebrated St. Patrick's Day like anybody else, but I'd be much more inclined to celebrate Saint something, Saint Happy Little Round Guy, Czech person, happy. I don't know what that would be. Saint Czech, there must be somebody. This is really interesting times, so much happening with the tsunami in Wisconsin. And this weekend, there's the March 19 protests, and Bradley Manning is still incarcerated. March Madness, basketball, everybody's paying attention to that. And spring. Spring is always a time for hope for me. Spring training. The Minnesota Twins are going to spring training, or they've been here about 2 weeks. And I just heard from a friend I haven't heard from for a long, long time. We went to high school together, and we played baseball together. We won the state championship that year. And he's talking about being a baseball coach in Stillwater, Minnesota. And he's talking about trying to listen to the radio show, but they might have indoor batting practice today. And that's really a sign of spring to me. I remember playing ball, and you walk out on the green grass, and you just everything is just okay at that point. It's kind of the unspoken message of hope, and the whole concept of this New American Dream project is about hope. It's hope in the now and also in the future, that Americans will get our collective heads out of our asses to look at the things that we really should be concerned about. We're taking off our shoes in airports when it was Bush and not the guys with the 007 decoder rings who did it. And when we now re-realize our whole culture could be wiped away by a nuclear power incident, and we are worrying about whether we can take pineapple kiwi shampoo on a trip to Seattle. And that's because our leaders are not leading us. They're leading us, but they're leading us like a Judas goat over the cliff, because they do not speak for us. They do not care about us. And how do we say this? They in general are not good people. They are not all like Bernie Sanders of Vermont. They are more like George and George Bush and Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. They rule not for the benefit of the masses, but for the few, the rich. They are deceivers. And this I believe. And this just in from Deborah Sweet of The World Can't Wait regarding the protest plan for this weekend. She says the world doesn't have to be this way. It's just the way it is now. People say things won't ever change, and that's wrong. The people of Tunisia and Egypt showed that there is no guarantee that brutal dictatorships will last forever, even when they're backed up by the most powerful military in the world. The public workers and students of Wisconsin surprised everyone in massing for weeks against an attempt by those grouped around the Republican Party to break them. The people of the Middle East and those of the heartland in this country have surprised everybody by waking up. The unjust occupation of Iraq, the war on the people of Afghanistan, the drone bombings of Pakistan and Yemen, the secret wars, the black sites or torture and rendition, Obama's indefinite detention, the repression against Muslims and anti-war activists, all of this is growing worse and seems permanent, but none of these are permanent. And our world doesn't have to be this way. It's just the way it is, because we have not yet stood up to it in enough numbers to back down the forces of empire and repression. We're going into the streets on this 8th anniversary of the attack on Iraq with a new sense of the potential we hold. See you there, she says. At Obama's election, we were believing in hope, openness, and that there would be no wrong questions, believing in truth. We dream of becoming the type of people, the nation that we always thought we were, and it didn't happen. We have to ask ourselves why. It's one of those questions that we are allowed to ask, that we should ask. It's wrong, and it's frustrating. To me, to know the truth about our history is the most important thing. If that can happen, I believe the rest takes care of itself, grows legs, as they say. Taxes we pay for these lies. This lie that the military protects us, this lie that the USA stands for freedom, this lie that it's okay to kill. And I wonder if we'll ever have the courage to do what the people of Egypt have done. It's not because we don't have a reason. It's more in line with, have we got anything better to do today? The ones with the power desperately depend on our being afraid. And we cannot be afraid.
Rock Creek gently flows through the parkland of Washington, D.C. until it meets the mighty Potomac River in the heart of the federal city. On the other hand, Rock Creek Free Press is a fiercely independent newspaper that's not afraid to print the truth. We print the stories that others won't touch. The 9/11 cover-up, media propaganda, government corruption,
state terrorism, and violations of our constitutional rights. The Creek is a completely reader-supported publication. We accept no corporate advertising, no corporate influence. For a free, no-obligation issue of The Creek, just go to rockcreekfreepress.com. If you want copies for your local 9/11 truth group, send your request to editor@rockcreekfreepress.com. Rock Creek Free Press, not afraid to print the truth.
And now, back to the show with your hosts, Chuck Gregory and Mike Pelichek.
And now it's time for the news briefs.
This Saturday, as I mentioned, will be International Day of Action to Resist the War Machine. And for a list of actions, where to go, you can go to answercoalition.org. Also from UnitedForPeaceAndJustice.org, there's they have a list of 765 towns and cities in all 50 states that are holding events on Saturday. The number and geographic spread of these events reflects the growing breadth of the anti-war movement, they say. Last year, on the first anniversary of the war, 319 cities and towns across the United States organized events.
These items come to us from The Sparrow Sings, the newsletter from Don and Roberta of the Milwaukee Catholic Worker. Over a 15-month period, Corrections Corporation of America, CCA, spent $4.4 million lobbying the Immigrant and Customs Enforcement, Department of Homeland Security, both houses of Congress, and other government bodies. Five of CCA's most lucrative contracts with ICE have no end date. As a result, ICE is devoting less funding to immigration policies that meet basic human rights standards. Meanwhile, CCA owners who refer to detained immigrants as product are set to reap huge profits. The federal government spends $60.50 per inmate per day at the detention center. More immigrants, the bigger profit. B, farm workers help a $28 billion fruit and vegetable industry in the U.S. 85% is hand-harvested or cultivated. Three-quarters of U.S. farm workers earn less than $10,000 a year. Three of five farm worker families have the Awa Gul, a 48-year-old Afghan prisoner at Guantanamo Bay for 9 years without charge or trial, was scheduled to be held forever. He died in a shower after suffering a heart attack February 4th, 2011. And D, on March 24th, there's an anti-ROTC vigil at Marquette University. No more studying and teaching of war, stop the armed occupations, teach Christ's message of nonviolence, not the government's message of violence.
And also at Marquette, they are praying and fasting. It's been going on every Wednesday since March 9th. The next time will be March 23rd. It goes through April 13th. It's from 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. You meet at 3:50 on the sidewalk in front of Rainer Memorial Library to end the war in Afghanistan, to close the School of Army, Navy, Marines, and Air Force. Marquette University supports unjust and immoral wars in Iraq and Afghanistan by hosting an officer military recruiting and training centers on campus that teaches values like priority of military values over conscience. And this is from the Alabama Against the Death Penalty. Governor Pat Quinn of Illinois signed a bill this week abolishing the death penalty in Illinois, saying, since our experience has shown that there is no way to design a perfect penalty system free from numerous flaws that can lead to wrongful convictions or discriminatory treatment, I have concluded that the proper course of action is to abolish it. And the letter goes on to state that the people wish that the Alabama governor would consider what the governor in Illinois has done. This is from Citizens for Legitimate Government. Each U.S. citizen pays $5,000 per year for U.S. defense spending. American citizens are paying large amounts of money each year for U.S. defense spending, which can be used for domestic spending. Steve Breiman, the assistant professor at the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, said, each and every citizen in the U.S., man, woman, and child, pay some $5,000 per year for U.S. defense spending, much of which is associated now with the two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. If the federal government had not spent some $1 trillion on the wars, that money would have been available for domestic spending, including the balance in the budget, Perman said. You can have healthy public finances, or you can have war, but you cannot have both.
And that's the way it is, March 17th, 2011.
I would like to now welcome our guest poet, Lee Herrick from Minneapolis. Lee Herrick is a Minneapolis poet, writer, and hand drummer whose collaborations, poems, essays, music, and reviews have appeared in a variety of print and electronic journals, including most recently Omega 7, The Jive and Ladybug, Ditch, Jacket, and forthcoming Skid Row Penthouse. Her first book of poems is slated for publication in 2011 by Howling Dog Press. You can also go to www.leeherrick.com. You can also follow her on Facebook. Lee, hello.
Hey, how are you?
How you doing? Yeah, this is the first time we've ever talked.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, you bet. You're in Minneapolis, is that correct?
Yes, I am.
How's the weather down there? Getting nice, huh?
Yes, we're pushing 50s, and it's about time. We've had a lot of snow this year, and most of us haven't enjoyed the last 3 or 4 weeks of it.
Isn't that something? I was telling, Chuck Gregory down in Fort Lauderdale said the weather was about 80 there, and I think we had about almost 50 here, and I was saying how awful nice that sure feels.
Well, that's it. You know, up in the Northland, we consider 50 in March as a heat wave.
Yeah. Tell me, how you got started with your poetry?
Oh, boy. It goes back pretty far. I think I composed my first musical piece, a rhythmic piece, which, of course, poetry is rhythmic at a certain level. With my brother, when I was about 4 and he was about 3, and I had him do one humming part, and I came in with another humming part, and I would say that was probably the roots, you know. So, as far as officially, I was 18. I had had poetry in high school, and that's a plug for keeping poetry in the high schools. I know that the arts are under attack, but after having followed poetry classes in high school and taken some Shakespeare in high school, I just kept writing poetry. And after I graduated, I was 18, and I remember very clearly I was at a kitchen table writing a poem, and I said, this is it. This is my vocation. I'm going to be a poet. So I am.
Isn't that something? That must felt awful good to your decide that.
Well, I mean, in retrospect, it seems rather audacious, because I think the calling of the poet is pretty high. But I hung in there with it, and I was just convinced that it had a lot of social value, and I was not willing to compromise my ideals, and I hung with it. And I think it wasn't until I was about maybe 38 that I actually allowed myself to introduce myself to people as a poet.
I still don't do that. I don't tell anybody I'm a writer, I guess. But you've got guts.
Well, maybe I do. I don't know how much guts I have, but I have conviction, so maybe those are synonymous. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Could you read a few of your poems for us, please?
I sure will. I'm going to start out with a piece that I wrote in 2007. It came out in Visions International. And really, when I'm reading this piece right now, I am thinking of the people in Japan. I know so many of us are heartbroken over, what is happening there. So this is called What Will You Carry? This last page, the stain of wine from our lips, waves from the battered headlands. Are we here long enough? And what do you make of it? What can you around silos and hydrogen pits in the end? What around drill deadened rigs and mountains prepared for you of the former embedded, now dead young, sent irretrievably home? Past crescendo, poem without resolve. What will you make of it, wind? I'm going to move on to one of my surreal pieces. This is called Silence. I'm very preoccupied with social silence, especially as a poet. So this is called Silence, and like I said, this is one of my surreal pieces, so just let it flow over you. Silence. There is no other mouth out of which I might speak. There is no other laboriously alphabetized chain of symbols from which I might draw each note past its criminal caesura, springing into the empty canal of sound carved against time's mimetic echoing trickle. There is no void for the blind dweller of nothing eradicated into decoration. There is no hour, no expanse of day, no hair parted, no elbow leaned upon, no hip ground into, no brow wiped of its bead, no quivering lip, no ecstasy expressed, not a single touched tongue that doesn't know its own aching, its own low fog against the graying armpit of reason. Deliverer of shorn facts in the archaeology of deconstructed buttock and planetary thigh, wrapped around womb and ocean pelvic sunrise, there is no inflated language for the millennia of heartbeat forms breathed into blood, into diamond toes, into shimmering liquid, broken toward finger dawn. There is only this melted ticking, this wound of truculent haze, for which, in a galaxy of hours, handed over the billion palms coloring the universe's trillion limbs, I have only the pointillist's dots, only the noon-painted paucity, only these flecks of flung resistance, this anti-station charged by its indeterminate ruddy thrum, galloping against its midnight terror, its Edenic antipathy, its conditional rant of marauding gods fallen like horizons leapt of their own pervasive rims from which this fractious and besieged root clings, exculpatory as an Amazonian prayer or poem. I'll move on now. This is called In the Pantry of Illusion. Control. Antarctic death roll. Glaciered, faceted, surfaced, perimeter, today's feature being monkey comparative, proportional countenance, daylight's extremity dawned for. This, down, dimmed, dumb, made numbly, sublime word, false. Counterfeit transcendence, forged upon green blades, a blown trajectory of mathematicians, poets, scientists, musicians, hallelujah, the bomb of it handed beyond neighbor, the bomb of it handed beyond foreign, the bomb of it made alienation, friction, moon watering, birth of new star, unimove, wave of it, and your electric heart indistinguishably stopped. This is, next one is called Maybe. Maybe we won't. Maybe the stooled words of incrementality forging comfort will provide. Maybe the haunting voices of unnoticed children missing in polite poems will remain unobserved, and maybe like the mountain whose name had always been vitriol. Maybe the indignant mountain called untamable uprising will grasp at the sky. Maybe it will. Just as maybe that romantic futurism of the triple rainbowed event will prove itself one way or another, and maybe grass will bow to it, unhidden from secrecy's green desire. Maybe clouds will lift their skirts, egging the mountain on, and there will only be a calamity of joy. Or maybe there will be nothing at all. Maybe diffused streaks of ancient graphics loping toward this day's fabrication of act as eradication, not asking where are the bones of the mother, will blend into word art, frozen to monitors, waiting in the depths of the stilled. Okay, I think I have about 4 minutes left, so I'm going to skip ahead of my plans here. I'm going to read, this is called Spring. On the backs of the Anatolians, on the backs of the Clovis, on the backs of the Africans, on the backs of the Moors, on the backs of the healers, on the backs of the fathers, on the backs of the Jews, on the backs of the Mayans, on the backs of the blacks, on the backs of the gays, on the backs of the women, on the backs of the boys, on the backs of the girls, on the backs of the Christians, on the backs of the men, on the backs of the Marxists, on the backs of the crossers, on the backs of the mountains, on the backs of the mothers, on the backs of the poets, on the back of the hand, the word escaped, mistaken for wings. I think I'll end with one piece for Wisconsin that goes back to 2003. It wraps up with all what's going on in the world right now, and it is an anti-war piece. This is called Driving Past the Kalahari Water Park on the Anti-War Committee Bus. I wrote this after coming home. After Bush 2 invaded Iraq, and I went to D.C. to protest. So I'm curious that this Kalahari Water Park of the Wisconsin Dells is taken from the Kalahari Desert, and it just struck me going by, as a weird sort of symbol of the culture of amusement in America. And the other thing that struck me was how things get named. And usually they often reflect places of conquest, whether that implies past, present, or future. So here's the poem. Met a Vietnam vet who told the tale of coming home and told how every time a war breaks out, his buddy gets stressed and flooded in recall and for a time goes LOA, entirely from life. And riding home, replete with late October leaves as reds and oranges on trees are turning mostly brown to dead and all the grass rolled into hills has lost its green. She, unnamed, is suddenly telling, with her son at her side, of five generations buried in Arlington. And from behind the anticlimactic bullhorned introductions made post-protest, she cries, saying, I was a stateside nurse through Nixon, then Ford. But now, by God, I came to say, not my son. By God, in this generation, not my son. And we are going by America. En route, on bus, we are passing a heartland emptied of horses and cows, a hummocky terrain of hay and stubbled fields. We are passing the bullhorn between us, beneath overcast skies, passing truckers who haul you as you are, rigged over highways and 18-wheeled cabbed over deliverance as we return, done in D.C., come home to brush and bathe and scour our TVs, alert to reliable reports on numbers we made, alert to who we will be, waiting, alert to who we were, passing windowed acreage and farm for sale signs, passing all the long calls of whistle-blown trains, passing even the singular black cat caught hunting in a ditch, seen from the chartered bus's brief glassed-over flash between all other flashes of blues in red and white frames signifying all harmless changes between the utterly harmed and changed. That's it, Mike.
Lee, thank you very much. Those are really beautiful.
Thank you for having me.
You have a new project coming out with Howling Dog. Do you want to? Is there anything to say yet about that? How to get it? Or?
Oh yeah. Are you referring to the book?
Yeah.
The book is we're just starting putting it together. Michael Annis and I. And I'd like to give a big shout out to Michael Annis of Howling Dog Press. You know him. I know him. He really gets behind writers like us, poets like us, who are often put off to the margins. So, you know, big kudos to Michael. But, we're just starting it, and we anticipate that it will be published and ready for review and readings either this summer or fall.
That sounds great. I hope. And I hope you'll consider coming back on the show and reading some more and telling us more about that project.
Oh, absolutely. I'd love to anytime.
Thank you very much. You have a good night.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mike.
Okay. You bet. See ya.
This public service announcement is brought to you by the DEA, the prison construction industry, and your local and federal politicians, since who knows when. Thanks, Jesus. Thanks, Buddha. Thanks, Allah, for the drug wars. How long has it been? Since Bush Sr., mid-80s? Since Reagan? Followed up faithfully by Clinton and more Bush. And really all your neighbors and church council members as well, huh? Locking human beings into cages for 10, 20, 30 years, making their children cry their way into adulthood alone. That's us. We're everyone who ever worked to bring you the drug war. Hey, can we talk now? It wasn't about criminals, dude. Look at the bankers, all those who got us into war by lies, those who made money on killing. Look at the billions of dollars alcohol industry. I've never hurt anybody. Oh, no. Oh, well, that stuff, that's not illegal. Marijuana is. It's a natural growing plant, and we made it illegal. Pretty cool. Well, here's to you. Thank you for watching television, playing miniature golf, and protecting the world from white-tailed deer. For all you do, this bud's for you.
And this show is also brought to you by your local county jail. Give us your tired, huddled masses yearning to be free, and we'll lock them up. We'll put them in a small, dirty, old, crowded, out-of-the-way county jail. Tens of thousands of them throughout the U.S., more than McDonald's, and we do it our way. If you've got poor people or some who came from somewhere else, if they are stupid enough to think the Statue of Liberty is holding up a torch and not a middle finger, send them to us. We'll teach them about America. We'll stick it to them our way. We're your local county jail. We are not the Holiday Inn. We are not Mother Teresa. We are not a country club. This is jail, and we get paid to work here. And then we can buy beer at the Homeland Tavern on our way home with our money and forget. God bless America. This show is also brought to you with a grant from Bread for the Billionaires. 45,000 to 50,000 die every day from starvation, far out. Help Bread for the Billionaires fight world eating If you will act now, you can help to increase that number. Bread for the billionaires, because if you can still hear this message, you're eating too much. Poverty is not the problem. It's the solution. Member FDIC. And make sure to watch this Wednesday night on CBS after American Idol. Are you smarter than a prison guard? And for our viewers around the world, be sure to watch Are You Smarter Than an American? Coming soon, Por Todo El Mundo Este Verano.
And now, it's time for our special interview with Jack Cohen Joppa. He's a 54-year-old native of Colorado, came into the anti-nuclear movement during the 78-79 year-long occupation of the railroad tracks leading into the now-closed Rocky Flats nuclear weapons factory outside of Denver. A prior interest in prisoner advocacy, combined with awareness of imprisoned nuclear opponents, led to him co-founding in 1980 the National No Nukes Prison Support Collective. He published their unique newsletter, The Nuclear Resistor. Jack is married to co-editor Felice Cohen Joppa. They have two grown children. They've made their home in Tucson since 1986. Jack, welcome to our show.
Thanks. Glad to be here with you.
Well, I'm sure glad to have you with us. How scared are you? How scared should we be about the radiation that's going to come here from Japan?
At this point, I would say don't be scared, because when we're in a fearful or a panic mode, we don't make the best decisions. That's enough to tell us whether to flee or stay and fight. And at this point, we should stay and fight, because you can't outrun radiation forever. It's true that by the time any plume gets here, there would be dispersal, but that's only part of the story. So I would say don't panic yet, but pay attention, educate yourself, don't be smitten by technology or intimidated by the experts. Use some common sense, and maybe I can help with some perspective for that point.
So have you started with iodine or kelp or those things?
Well, certainly I eat well. I eat a lot of cruciferous vegetables. I maybe should eat more sea vegetables, because that is the best and highest source of natural iodine to keep your thyroid well supplied. That's the point of potassium iodide. It keeps the thyroid well supplied with iodine, so that it functions properly. And if it's not well supplied, then it might take up the radioactive isotopes that are one of the more active products released from this type of a nuclear contamination story. And that only covers, you know, one organ, one isotope. It happens to be the easiest one to do some prophylactic work, you know, at hand, but the best prophylactic is to eat well. And like I said, sea vegetables, cruciferous vegetables, miso without boiling it, just to stir it into the hot soups. These are all proven, you know, radiological health remedies that I would encourage people to be eating right first and foremost. The prophylactic use of pharmaceutical-grade potassium iodide has very real risks for some people, and it should not be done without consultation with a health professional, is my advice. But having it on hand, if you live near a reactor in the United States, very good idea, because when the time comes, if that reactor should go, you'll want to have your prophylactic dose on hand rather than having to wait in line. That's the danger. It's really the, okay, you know, when you're really close to your reactor. That's why the government has it in their plan to distribute potassium iodide as one measure following a reactor incident like we see in Japan.
Okay. Well, I think I might get some for my medicine cabinet, but I'm going to concentrate on eating well, as you've suggested. I thank you for that advice. What's your take on what's really going on over in Japan with these reactors? How big a cover-up has started already? And will we ever know?
Well, there are things that we will never know. Let's start at the very top of the thing that we will never know is the total extent of radiation contamination. Estimates will be given. Some will be presented as conclusive. But the reason no one can know is because a large part of the monitoring equipment was destroyed by either the earthquake or the tsunami or the explosions after those events. So, number one, we will never know how much escaped. We don't know where plumes of particularly contaminated material may touch down on land and then contaminate, you know, that area more than, say, you know, 100 yards away even, you know, is part of the dynamics, particularly in closer regions to the plant. So we won't know how much in the long run. And that makes it difficult, it's true, for TEPCO, the owners, to be authoritative in what they have to say. And that's why there's a difference of opinion now with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission saying it's, you know, worse than TEPCO admits. They're taking airborne monitors. I am not aware of that data being publicly released at this time. I'm not a scientist to follow the numbers closely, but I'm on lists with other people who do follow that sort of thing, and I haven't seen the numbers posted from any of the military monitoring that's undoubtedly been going on from day one. That's why the aircraft carrier was there, as they're doing radiation monitoring. That's how they knew to move away. But I don't know that we've seen those numbers. And so it makes it difficult. We know that certain elements are present. That's what leads to the conclusion that they had, you know, breach of core containment, at least at some point along the way early on. What's going to happen now? In one way, you and I know as much as the experts do because they're totally flying by the seat of their pants. You know, they have manuals and plans drawn up for contingency A, B, C, and D, but we're on beyond the alphabet now. And they're, you know, flying helicopters and spraying water from boats like this is just a normal fire. But what's going on is intense gamma radiation in the immediate vicinity of those reactor buildings. And you can't even get people on site for more than 10 or 15 minutes, for example, at a time before they've exceeded an annual radiation dosage and they need to jump back out. They're called jumpers in nuclear industry lingo. They go in, they extend the radiation dosage. Well, they don't have that many workers to do that with. I don't know how they're managing this fact, but they need to somehow stop the gamma radiation that's the most deadly close to the reactor to even get in to fully assess the damage. So, I mean, they're in a pickle, and this is going to go on for a while. It's like a slow-motion, real-life horror movie.
It certainly is. Do you think that, say, Hawaii is in trouble, or is it far enough away that it's likely to have dissipated?
I really would worry more about the people of Japan, you know, because they're going to have the chance
of
this being swept over them in a higher concentration than the people of Hawaii. Although, you know, that's like the tsunami. You know, the tsunami had dissipated to some degree when it got to Hawaii, but there were, you know, docks destroyed. And likewise on the West Coast, and the best we know about radiation is that any increase in radiation dose results in a statistical increase in ill health effects of one form or another. There's no safe dose of radiation or safe level below which there's no health impact. There's questions about what happens way, way down the scale with really minute quantities of radiation and how it impacts and where it is in your body, but there's no disputing the fact, and this is what regulations are built upon, that there is no safe dose of radiation. And so we draw up regulatory limits based in part on economic considerations. What is economical to achieve in the industry versus for the public? So like for the industry, in the nuclear industry in the United States, workers are allowed permissible exposures that exceed what the general population is allowed. It's just kind of assumed that you can get a heavier dose in the course of a year than they calculate for the general population. So,
well, after all, they're getting paid
are we at
for
risk?
It, right?
What's that?
well,
I mean, are we at risk in Hawaii? I mean, that was the question. It's like, yes, there is some degree of risk. what it is relative to, say, all of the radionuclides released into the atmosphere from atmospheric nuclear weapons testing, which was a lot of plutonium, and it's still in the atmosphere, and it's still part of the air we breathe, and people statistically do die from that. This adds incrementally to that sort of background natural plus background human-caused radiation burden on our species. So statistically, yeah, people are going to get sick. How many, and can you nail down radiation as the cause of your friend, you know, Gina's cancer in Hawaii? Probably not, because there were a lot of things impacting Gina's life. But does it impact overall? Yes. I mean, they always say, you know, the radiation level was not high enough to be of concern to the public. Well, how many repetitions of that statement can be made before you finally have to add it all up and say, well, yes, there is a harm to the public? So it's disingenuous to say that the radiation levels exceeding limits or regulations are now no danger to the public. Well, what's the point of the regulation in the first place?
Well, that's certainly true. I wish we could continue this. I have a lot of things to ask you, but unfortunately, we're running late, and I'm going to have to cut it short.
Okay, that's fine. Can I give a website just for the work we do?
I certainly would like you to tell us briefly about your website and the nuclear resistor.
The nuclear resistor, we chronicle anti-nuclear and anti-war civil resistance. And our principal purpose is to keep track of and support the people who are in jail as a result of these kind of actions. So our website, nukeresistor.org, has a list of currently imprisoned anti-nuclear and anti-war activists and how you can write to them. And it's a blog there that kind of highlights some of the activity that we report on comprehensively in the print edition of the Nuclear Resistor newsletter. You can sign up at the website and we'll send you a free sample copy.
Well, thank you for that. Keep on working, and we will look forward to getting you back here in a few months, and we'll talk some more.
All right.
I hope we don't have any current events that are taking up our whole time the way that this Japan disaster has.
Yeah.
So
well,
that we can talk a little more about the protest side of things. But
yeah.
I appreciate your sharing this information with us tonight, and thank you for being on our show.
All right, thanks, Chuck. Bye.
Well, it's been a long week in Mount Liberty, Nebraska, my hometown. Jack Robert King and Elena Usak are not married, but together they operate the pirate radio station in Mount Liberty, KEFU. Sometimes from a basement, sometimes an attic, sometimes from the back seat of a roving blue and white 1981 green and white Chevy Citation. On Wednesday morning, Jack Robert King was doing the morning drive time show. He was actually in the front window of McDonald's with his laptop and a pair of $10 headphones from Amazon. He was doing the daily Tolstoy report. Perhaps we can listen in.
I suppose you all heard about Japan and Wisconsin. And there's 25 to 30,000 people who die around the world today from starvation. Bradley Manning, still being held at Quantico, giving us news about the murders our sons and daughters are committing overseas. And the construction of the new nuclear weapons plant continues, Kansas City. We got that going for us. Father Jack McCaslin. He'll soon be going to federal court in Omaha for protesting against nuclear weapons off an Air Force base. Mark Kenney's already been sentenced for the same protest to 6 months in federal prison, waiting to be assigned to a particular prison. The immigrants trying to get up here from Agua Prieta, Mexico, crossing over at Douglas, Arizona, then walking hundreds of miles through minefields of Bubbas and Sons of Bubbas, just to get here, get their kids on the school bus route. They keep coming, they keep dying every day. Hey, did your grandparents or great-great-grandparents come from somewhere else? Ireland? Germany? Norway? Just asking. Onward. Hey, don't forget the annual Easter Sons of Joseph and Mary slave auction in the Good God Almighty Parish Hall. Proceeds go toward Boy Scout Troop 129 Arizona Desert Summer Camp, the immigrant roundup for underprivileged children. For more info, contact Mrs. Hjalmar Hjalmarsson, Mrs. Dutch Inkvist, or Mrs. Mohammed Bunsen. Also, more signs of spring. Mrs. Norden Nordyke passes along the word. She has 120 new kittens to give away and more on the way every day. Y'all know where to go. And now for the prison, drunk tank, quarantine, holding pen, concentration camp, jail, correctional facility, school suspension and detention period report. Let's see. Gitmos, it's the local FEMA concentration camp. Like McDonald's, it's a chain. The Freedom County Jail, well, we'll get to both of them in a bit. There are many jails in Freedom County. Gitmos, Penitentiary, City Jail, County Jail, Immigrant Detention Center, and State Hospital. Many jobs available as guards, cooks, fence builders, and block layers. Everyone willing to give a hand, help out, get a check, health insurance, get by, turn a key, lock up your neighbor, whisper, get through one more day, guide the steering wheel with one hand while ripping the fingernails of the other hand with your teeth. Turning into the parking lot, go to work to make it one more day. Hand over hand, tugging the rope that never ends.
If you recall, on the cover of the August 15th, 1959 Saturday Evening Post is an illustration of a young couple pitched against each other, leaning back against a tree, dreamy gazes in their eyes as they stare into the night sky overhead. They're dreaming the American dream. They see dot sketches, perhaps formed by the stars, of their future. Appliances, toasters, washers, dryers, can openers, home, swimming pool, refrigerator with ice dispenser. Maybe those dreams have been put there by advertising, or CIA implants, or the uncle from Paducah, but it is certain they do not realize those are not elective items. Those modern conveniences are mandatory dreams, so to say. For on the back side of that dream, of that dark blue night curtain, the flip side of that 45 playing Johnny Angel, is a prison camp, an American prison camp in the Midwest, with corn on the left and soybeans on the right, a big orange moon on a summer night, with electronic eavesdropping equipment visible on the man's nose as he stares down at a big sparkling red DeSoto humming down a deserted highway, with Grandma and Grandpa Jones listening to the ball game on the radio, with their hands out the window trying to catch the wind. The locusts waver and the wind dies down. The announcers sign off, and the white-tailed deer stand in the field listening. The red sun shines on the barn sides, and the new kittens lick at the milk left in the bowl by the back door. Tractors headed off down the lane for the fields, and a UPS truck left behind a wake of dust and smoke. It skidded to a stop to make the corner up Gitmo's Lane. They called it Gitmo's because the farm, small ranch really, once belonged to a paraplegic rancher, farmer really, name of Morris. And when the government bought the property, the name stayed since the guards were all from around here. Not much remained of the old place. It was more of a parking lot now than a working farm or ranch that had a husband and wife and seven children running around everywhere, enough to keep the grass down without mowing. They still had dogs, though.
In town, the county jail squatted beneath the Freedom County Courthouse, as invisible as a good boy to those walking outside. Those prisoners needing to appear in county court would crowd handcuffed and shackled into the elevator in the jail front lobby. Two guards for the ride up two floors. Door would open into a world of color. People in a hurry, people whose days flew by, people with smiles on their faces, with faces serious about nothing. The door would open and reveal the load of orange men with scraggly matted hair, men with no reason to shave, just roused from a nap, who just walked into a department store holding the hand of a little girl. The girl asked the sleeping man what she could have, and he said nothing, and he woke up in jail with real tears coming down his cheeks. The door split in two and revealed to the hurried people a crowded little room of orange men, who were the reason for the huge building of marble and concrete and stone and hardwood and the salad bar and the lounge. These almost men with their bowed heads and tangled hands propped in front of their waists like they were holding a wet spot shuffled crossway over the lanes of traffic with difficulty, like passing through a cornfield against the roads. Two brown men stood on the sides of the orange men, keeping them from the hurried people who carried papers, the lives of the orange men and their children. In 3 seconds, four, the orange and brown men slipped inside the lonesome door that led to the damp holding tank outside the rear courtroom door.
At 1 a.m., the night guard clicked down the hall. His flashlight moved with his right leg. He barked at his walkie-talkie, not bothering to be quiet for the sleeping prisoners. The doors of the sally port clanged open. The guard stalked in click-click down the row, shining a light into each cell, counting to himself. "Morning," a prisoner said. "Morning," said the guard, walking past. He strode back without speaking. The prisoner sat on the top bunk, his bare feet hanging over the side. He rolled another cigarette. He watched the shadow on the cement floor, his neighbor doing push-ups. The doors clanged shut. The guard and the prisoner repeated the scene at 2 and 3, and at 4 o'clock count, the prisoner was asleep. As the night guard checked the blocks each hour and talked to the street cops who brought in prisoners and the woman who worked the front desk, while the lights at the street corner clicked from green to yellow to red, and the kids drove past, the men in D block dreamed like summer campers. They dreamed of being 20 feet to the north. What could that possibly be like? They had never been there before. They had each been born in jail. They had never seen their mothers or held their children. They had always known the guards, always known their names. They had always been there in the morning, telling them when to eat, to read, to watch television. They dreamed of really blue sky, flying up through the clouds, falling down into clouds and bouncing lightly. They dreamed of playing softball and baseball. Their dogs licked their faces as they slept. They made love to fairy princesses. They told their fathers they loved them and helped their mothers peel apples for pie. They laughed and they smiled wide. I wonder their faces did not crack and clatter to the floor like old pottery during a change in the weather. They cried as it came near the time they had to leave their loved ones and blindly wiped real tears from their cheeks. They reached out their arms and could not reach out because of the top bunk or the ceiling. They moaned and they jerked and they sobbed some more. They grabbed themselves, not wanting to walk down the cold upstairs hall to pee. Teetering on the precipice of their dreams, they heard the school custodian's whistle down the hall. They heard the jingling of a little brother's toys in the living room. They heard someone reaching for keys to start a truck. They clenched their teeth at the click of hard shoes on smooth, shiny concrete. They heard the metallic tasting language of a machine. They opened their eyes and saw their mothers had flipped on their bedroom light against their wishes. They felt the coarse blanket on their shoulders, heard the growl of the first guard shift. Breakfast. And the mechanical opening of their cages. They opened their eyes, squinting, then rolled to their backs and shut their eyes, trying to retrieve their dreams, remembering they were in prison.
One man awakened to the sound of shuffling cards. A new man had moved into the old man's cell overnight. The four played spades at the table. Each smoked. Television blared in the corner. A car squealed away. The water in one cell dripped, dripped. The hands of the men curled gently over the tips of the cards, like they might yet touch the shoulder of a woman. The fingertips of the men, clamshells, stained yellow from rolled cigarettes, scooped up each dealt card, split them into suits. "I ain't got shit. Come to Papa. Good hands." Cuffed around muffled voices, calling to those outside. "Quit trying. Aces, come on home." The hands of the young man were smooth as chamois. No gullies cut deep from years of hanging to the edge. Fingers still learning to roll. Never learned to type. Teenage hands drawing superheroes on a piss-yellow steel table. The hands of the old man drank coffee with both hands around the dirty white cup marked in pen like a mother's cheek. Nothing ever certain. The hands of the men, long, white, soft, and slender, stubby and streaked, black, brown, nails torn, bleeding, manicured, and ready. The men sat on steel chairs bolted to the floor. Between games, the young man walked to the frosted cell window, wrapped his hands around the steel bars, trying to force them apart, fit his head where he thought no one watched. He had to try. Crude tattoos covered one's knuckles and fingers. "You see this one, dude?" he asked the new guy. Their wrists were familiar with the chilly caress of steel. A guard stomped down the hall, keys jingling. "I got court today," said one. "That's a whole day sitting in a holding cell. Gonna miss my visit. We supposed to order store today. Shit." "No court. Visit," said the guard. Hands know just where to be so a guard can snap on. Out in the parking lot, the hands of the women rummaged for change, digging past food stamps, baby food, and old golds. The hands of the children raced to push the bell for the visiting room. The routine now part of their childhood, like cookies with lunch break and school plays in the fall. Hands mirrored hands in the plastic window in the visiting cubicle. The large hand caressed a small hand in a tiny bald fist. "Bye. Bye." Hands gripped stubby pencils. "Daddy loves you." Hands waved goodbye across the courtroom. "Who's driving you home? I'll call. I'm sorry." Hands, flushed and spotty with a new rash, examined at midnight under a dim light. "Just one more smoke left. Just one last one awake." Waved to the guard, making his first check of the shift. "How's it going, man?" "Top of the morning to you, dude. Beautiful night in the big city." "I would not know. I would not know." "Hey, you got a light? Thanks. You have a good one." "All right." Hand flicked button the steel toilet, held the photo, put it down gently on the puke green table. Inside, a Bible, a string of knotted cloth. Sweaty, shaking hands tied the cord around his neck, then to the bars, climbed to the top bunk. Hands made the sign of the cross. "Push off." Snap! Hands dangled loosely. Good hands.
That's the news from Mount Liberty, Nebraska, where all the soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats are cowards, and all the journalists are about average.
I'd like to thank you all for listening to our show tonight. Hope you'll stop back next week, same time and same place. Thanks again to the Rock Creek Free Press for sponsoring our show. And visit our website, newamericandream.net, and the show's website, theshow.newamericandream.info. Thank you, and good night, Mike.
Good night, Chuck. Stay warm. Good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Ken Lay. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.
I was over in Australia during Easter, which was interesting. Interesting to note, they celebrate Easter the same way we do, commemorating the death and resurrection of Jesus by telling our children a giant bunny rabbit left chocolate eggs in the night. Now, I wonder why we're fucked up as a race. Anybody got any clues out there?
Where do you get this shit from, you know? Why those two things, you know? Why not goldfish left Lincoln logs in your sock drawer, you know? As long as we're making shit up, go hog wild, you know? At least a goldfish with a Lincoln log on its back going across your floor to your sock drawer has a miraculous connotation to it. Mummy, I woke up today and there was a Lincoln log in my sock drawer. That's the story of Jesus. Who comes up with this shit? I've read the Bible. I can't find the word bunny or chocolate anywhere in that fucking book.
Rock Creek gently flows through the parkland of Washington, D.C. until it meets the mighty Potomac River in the heart of the federal city. On the other hand, Rock Creek Free Press is a fiercely independent newspaper that's not afraid to print the truth. We print the stories that others won't touch. The 9/11 cover-up, media propaganda, government corruption, state terrorism, and violations of our constitutional rights. The Creek is a completely reader-supported publication. We accept no corporate advertising, no corporate influence. For a free, no-obligation issue of The Creek, just go to rockcreekfreepress.com. If you want copies for your local 9/11 truth group, send your request to editor@rockcreekfreepress.com. Rock Creek Free Press, not afraid to print the truth.
Everything is going according to plan. You've logged on early and are just waiting for Black Op Radio to start. The studio's ready, the hosts are ready, the guest is ready. Are you ready? Because Black Op Radio is only 2 minutes away. New from U.S. author Mike Palachek, Camp America. Here's what American poet David Ray has to say. Mike Palachek reminds me of Socrates, the gadfly who asked unwelcome questions, Diogenes with his lantern looking in vain for an honest man, Chekhov, the man with the hammer challenging the complacent family to share...